Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Joined on the line now by Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Charlie McConlough. Good morning to you, Minister.
Good morning, Colm.
You're announcing today you're banning the use of electronic shock collars, the ones operated by handheld remote controls on dogs and cats, following a public consultation. When are we going to see this?
Well, I'll be introducing these regulations now over the next couple of months to bring this into reality, Colm, and it follows on a significant consultation that I've done over the last 3-4 months, and lots of engagement from the public as well, because we very much regard this as a welfare issue for animals. And I would have established about 18 months ago the Advisory Council on Companion Animal Welfare, and they recommended that this should be considered, and from that then the public consultation was carried out, and following on from that then now I'm now announcing the intention of introducing regulations to ban it. And as you said in your introductory there, it's important to be clear that what we're banning here and proposing to ban is the shock collars on dogs and cats where they're operated by remote control. In many instances, there is electric fences, for example, which are used around homes, and there's collars to manage those. We're not proposing to manage those because, of course, animals have the opportunity to voluntarily avoid that. But in cases where there's shock collars which are remotely controlled, and in some cases people use them for training, we don't regard that as being beneficial to animal welfare, and it's something I want to see discontinued in this country, and the regulations I'm introducing will provide for that.
All right, so people who put up a perimeter wire, it won't affect them, people maybe who let their dogs roam free on the property, but where there might be agricultural land adjacent, they won't be affected by this. For the people who will be affected by these remote control operated shock collars, people who currently have them on their dogs and cats, they won't be affected. They won't be required to remove them. Is that the case?
That's the case. So obviously, there is a situation whereby, in many instances, these are used at the moment, and that came through strongly and from some submissions as part of the the part of the public consultation. So, listen, I want to provide balance in relation to this, and the regulations I'm going to introduce will mean that from the date the regulation comes in, no new animals will be able to avail of the shock, or be able, there'll be no shock collars for new animals, and the only animals for women to be able to, pets would be able to be used on, would be those who actually take the time to register and give an explanation as to the reason for that. But
would you expect
the animal and the use of it?
Would you expect people to go out and buy shock collars now in advance of that deadline, because effectively they have a couple of months to do so?
No, I wouldn't. And from the moment the regulations come in, it won't be possible to be on any new young dogs or young cats. But there is a reality there that for some who would have trained their animals with this, and who, you know, and particularly maybe for older dogs or older cats, particularly older dogs, there's been established use. And in those instances, we want to phase that out, while understanding that that it is in use at the moment, and would create some difficulties where it has been used with a dog for a long time. So I think it's a proportionate response, Colm, and I certainly wouldn't expect anyone to be going out to buy shock collars now at this stage. And it's not something that's used very broadly, but it is something which isn't necessary, and raises significant issues from a pet welfare point of view. So I think this step now is one which will ensure that we provide the appropriate respect and care for our pets and our animals that they deserve.
Is this on the programme for government?
No, it's not something in the programme for government.
And so what prompted it, and what's the urgency with doing it now?
Well, it's something that's been strongly considered now over the last number of months. What prompted it basically was the overall approach we take as a state, and I take as a minister, and the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine takes, indeed, working closely with the Department of Rural Development as well, which is responsibility for in relation to dogs in particular, the need to make sure that our laws and policies are appropriate to protecting animal welfare and pet welfare in this instance. And obviously, welfare of animals is really important in relation to our food production system too, and it's something we constantly monitor and adjust as necessary and as new evidence might emerge. And in this instance, through the Companion Animal Welfare Committee, which I, Advisory Council, which I set up, bringing together all of the key stakeholders and organizations working in this space, it was something that they recommended to me to be considered. And then I conducted the public consultation to make sure we got everybody's view in relation to that. So I think we've taken, we've acted promptly in relation, but we've been very balanced in relation to giving time for this. And I think it's the right decision.
Any opposition to the move?
There were some, yes. Mainly individual dog owners who would use it at the moment. And that's something that I've taken on board in relation to the regulations I'll now be implementing by allowing those who register and for whom have had long-term use to continue to do so while seeing it actually phased out and become eliminated altogether in the country.
I want to ask you about something that's been dominating the headlines both here and indeed over in the UK for the past week. But closer to home, it's less than a week from the joint operation by Gardaí and others to move men from Dublin's Mount Street, people who'd been applying for international protection, to state-provided accommodation up in Crooks Lyng, where they were still accommodated in tents. But now today we see along the banks of the Grand Canal 80 tents, our colleague Karen Creed is reporting, along the banks of the Grand Canal, barely 400 metres away from Mount Street. This follows the Taoiseach saying to the Dáil last week that the situation wouldn't be allowed to develop again, but it has.
Yeah, well, listen, the situation is challenging, and we have seen over the last number of months, and indeed in the last few weeks, record numbers presenting in relation to seeking international protection. And that has put a lot of pressure on the system. Since the start of the year, we have sourced 4,000 accommodation places for those applying for international protection, but it has become more challenging. The state is working and the government is working intensively at the moment to source additional accommodation. The focus for the moment will be in sourcing state land where tented accommodation can be provided or state-owned buildings. So that work is ongoing. We don't want to see a situation whereby there is tents in public places that don't have the service and facilities in place. So the state are working on that at the moment. But there's no doubt, Colm, that the situation has been challenging given the numbers that we've seen over the last 2-3 months.
Would you accept that it looks like there isn't a plan? Because on the one hand, people are being told not to pitch tents on the street. On the other hand, they're being given tents. They're being moved to areas that are remote from the city centre, and then people return to the city centre and pitch tents. And there seems to be a patchy, at best, application of the bylaws of the city. It seems that there isn't a coherent plan as to where these people are going to be accommodated and what facilities they're going to be provided with commensurate with the numbers.
Well, I think there's no doubt it is a challenge, and it's a daily challenge because there's more people obviously coming every week, and that has put pressure on a situation whereby there has been limited places given the amount of effort and accommodation has been provided over the last number of months. But the government is working to source additional and particularly state-owned land to provide tented accommodation where the proper facilities are in place, and that has been worked on at the moment to ensure that we have sufficient places in the short term for everyone coming in. And of course, the key thing here then as well is, in terms of addressing the additional numbers, is making sure that we're putting the resources into speedily dealing with and processing the applications that come in. And we've seen an 85% increase in the number of staff dealing with this over the last period of time. Also, in the last couple of weeks, Minister McEntee has announced the reallocation of 100 Garda resources to also work in terms of the processing of this and to make sure it works efficiently and effectively.
Sure,
it's a speedy and fair and firm process that deals with applicants and ensures that those who need protection receive it, but also those that who don't meet the criteria, that they receive quick answers.
But at the same time, the speedy application or the speedy processing of applications can apply to the first stage of application, but there is the scope for appeal. But if you look at the European figures, 53% of people in 2023 who applied for asylum got it, and of the remaining 47%, a further 30% of people got it. So you're looking at anywhere between around 65-70% of people's applications being valid. Are you really telling people that a large number of people will be leaving the country as a result of their applications being turned down when you see the figures coming from the overall European numbers of applications?
Yeah, and that's why it's going to be important that we increase the capacity to work with other member states and other countries and to deal with this issue as well. And that's why the European Migration Pact is going to be particularly important to make sure that all countries are working together and that there is a coherent system in place. And obviously it's going to be important as well that we work closely with the UK in relation to the arrangements that are in place there. I know that's something that at government level we'll continue to address. But in the short term, we do have issues there in relation to accommodation, which we're working to address.
Apologies for interrupting you, but under the current Dublin 3 system, there have been situations where European countries have been willing to take people back where there has been secondary movement and the like. I think Helen McEntee, the Justice Minister, in front of the Oireachtas Justice Committee the week before last, in answer to Deputy Michael McNamara from Clare, said of 188 cases that EU countries were willing to take back, only 3 had been actioned. And in the case of the UK, over 200 applicants were, the UK was willing to take them back, and none had been sent back to the UK. So why is there any hope being held out for the new European Asylum and Migration Pact if the provisions of the current arrangements aren't being used?
Yeah, I suppose it's not something that's unique to our own country, Colm, and this has been a challenge that all countries across Europe have been experiencing over the last period of time, because we are in a situation of quite unprecedented turmoil in many parts of the world. We know that obviously in relation to the illegal invasion of Ukraine and the ongoing issues in relation to Palestine. And also then significant challenges in relation to North Africa and significant civil wars and strife there, which is leading to real challenges over the last 2-3 years across Europe. So as a result of that, there's been lots of engagement multilaterally, working with other member states and other countries as to how we can address this issue and this challenge. And from that work, the EU Migration Pact has emerged as a comprehensive way to deal with this, to try and address many of the issues that are there, and to make sure that there is a speedy system in place, and also then an effective system as well for acting on decisions at the end of that. And that's something we as a government are contributing with other member states to. But in the short term, obviously, we have a challenge in relation to accommodation, which we take very seriously, and which the government are working in terms of finding and sourcing state-owned land to provide tented accommodation to address the particular increase in numbers we've seen in the last number of weeks.
Okay, Charlie McConlogue, Minister for Agriculture, thanks for joining us this morning. And migration, no doubt an issue in the upcoming European elections. We'll be looking at what the other issues are as well in the first of a series of reports from Brian O'Connell coming up next.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.